Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. You know, this podcast presents me with the chance to speak to fascinating people I've met and share their life perspectives with you. A friend of mine once told me that his goal is to go to bed less dumb every night. Well, today's guest, Andy Sleet, has helped me in that regard each time we've talked, and I'm sure today will be no different. When we started doing this show, the thought was to invite guests who were doctors or other healthcare practitioners to share their specific learnings with the other medics out there, but we've now broadened that to other professionals whose worldview can help those of us in the medical professions do our job better. Admittedly, not all of our audience are in the healthcare professions, but many are. And today, my guest, Andy Sleet, is one of those guys. Andy's background's interesting and very different from many of the people who've been on this podcast. He started life as an electromechanical apprentice and 25 years later had risen to manage large teams with multi-million pound budgets. A change in that company led to Andy altering his life's course and becoming a coach, and more of that later, and he's not looked back since then. I've heard it said that the one key thing about common sense is, well, it's not that common. Well, Mr. Sleet has it in bucket loads, and I guess that's why he's so good at what he does. And is also a keen sportsman and views such pursuits as another way people can become the best versions of themselves. When not coaching businesses and individuals, Andy plays and coaches badminton. And I'm hoping to get some lessons down the line. And if we were to play badminton together, I think he'd be laughing so hysterically, he wouldn't really be able to do a great deal for me. Andy Sleet, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan. I'm not sure who you were talking about there.
You, my dear chap. You know, Andy and I have both been working with EMG, the European Medical Group, and the EMJ, the journal, looking at future options for the organization. And each time I've sat in a meeting with him, you know, he's very often the last one to speak. And he always says these really, really pithy comments. So I want to start off with how he got to where he is. And, you know, Andy, my dad left school in the East End when his father died, and he worked at a button factory to support his mum and sister. He was a teenager. When I was a lad, he told me that whatever I did, I should not sew buttons for a living. And when I very proudly told him that I wanted to be a doctor, a surgeon, he rolled his eyes at me and said, "You're going to be sewing buttons," meaning that my progress and success would be based on the work my hands could do rather than my brain. You got your start working as an electromechanical apprentice, as I said, and you told me that you realized very quickly that there wasn't that much scope for career progression just using your hands. How did that epiphany come, and what took you into management?
Well, I suppose that actually there's a lot of parallels there to what you've just been talking about. My dad was a bricklayer, and he was desperate for me not to go into a profession using my hands. And I did actually start life as a bank clerk. I lasted 2 months, and I'd also been offered the job as an engineering apprentice. 2 months into the bank clerk, I thought, I can't do this. So I changed against my father's wishes and went in to become this engineering apprentice. And I guess after all, you know, a couple of years, learned the skills using my hands and that sort of thing, I started looking at, okay, so how can I earn more money? And I started really going through pay structures. It was a wonderful company that had pay structures published. You know, you get to this level, you earn this much, you get to that level, you earn so much. And what it got to is it showed that the only way to go up the scales was through management. And it's kind of, I guess, to my dad's delight that he said, "Yeah, see, I told you, don't use your hands for a living. I don't want you having to break your back as a bricklayer like I've been." So that was really what first struck me to come to that conclusion.
And so, was there a clear course at the company to go into management, or was it, I want to be a manager? Oh yeah, okay, great. We'll stick you into a training course. How did that come about?
In the early days, it, you know, there was the Institute of Management, and they had a great management training setup, if you like. It was part of a very large organization, and they had a management training center which they would ship you off to for, you know, a couple of days here and there, and teach you some of this stuff. I have to say that most of the training came after the promotion. I think it's typical in lots of companies. There wasn't a lot of pre-planning in those days. It was, oh, the managers left. Who's the best technician in that arena? Well, let's promote them. And you didn't always get a great manager. And sometimes you lost a great technician in their technical role. But, you know, eventually the training was there, and we caught up after the event.
And it would seem that you had a very solid and continuous progression in management, and you were very successful until, well, something happened that threw a spanner in the works, to continue the engineering theme. Tell us about that spanner in the works and how it changed your life's course.
Yeah, it wasn't so much a spanner. It was more of a whole toolbox, mate. I mean, kind of what happened was the company had got a very long-serving, set of employees. It wouldn't be untypical for the length of service on average to be over 25 years. So it was kind of like jobs for life. And I think the leaders of the organization felt it had got a bit stale. So they decided that they were going to have a bit of a shake-up, and to show that everybody that they couldn't be messed with, the long story short is they found three people in high-profile positions, and they said, if we get rid of them, everybody will know that we can't be messed with, and people will just start towing the line. And I was one of those casualties, I guess. I was called in one day, and I was just literally sat down and said, look, you know, obviously there's nothing wrong with performance. Every one of your appraisals over the last 25 years have said brilliant, fantastic, go on, move forward. But sorry, you're not in our plans moving forward. We're going to let you go. And it was as sudden as that.
I've always, that expression, we're going to let you go, it's sort of, to me, it always sounds like when, you know, in the movies, the mafia say, you know, he's going to be retired, or we're going to pop him the cap. You know, we're going to let you go. It sounds so genteel, instead of, we're going to give you the biggest shock of your life. We're going to terminate your income. You're not going to have a job. I mean, it's pretty bloody brutal. But yeah, it turned out to be very good for you, right? And
absolutely.
Yeah. So, and we'll come on to that. But I want to look at something that happened to you. In the process, you learnt about the concept of values as a founding principle, how to build and run a business, how to treat people. And in fact, your business, which is called OYF Limited, and that stands for Optimize Your Future, I believe, which I know ties into your values. Talk to us about values, Andy. What do you mean by that? And it's not just putting up an inspirational poster in your lobby and paying lip service, right?
That's 100% true. I think, you know, in many organizations, especially when they're very, very large, often what happens is the senior management team say, right, okay, we need some values. And they sit down and it's all debated. What should our values be? And they come up with this statement of, this would be really cool. And I think if we take values as a subject and we think about, what does it actually mean in reality? The values of an organization are demonstrated throughout its interaction with all clients, with all employees, in fact, everywhere. I think we've all seen the odd advert on the telly, and the ones that particularly amuse me sometimes is various banks put out an advert and they say, oh, this is us, we're this type of bank, we're that type of bank. If you come in, this is the type of person that you're going to meet. And then we kind of reflect on reality and we say, well, actually, that's not been my experience when I've gone into the bank. So what's happened is they've set these values up. The marketeers have actually used that as the premise to communicate this is who we are. But there's a disconnect with what the external world sees. But it's the same with business. My view on this is you have a leader in the business, and it's either the owner or the managing director, the CEO. And that person will have a set of values. Now, it doesn't mean necessarily that their values are right or wrong, because it's something like about 400 or 500 different values, words to describe values. But that person will have their individual top 10. Now, the only way they can ever live to values is by actually stating the values of the company are their values. Now, if they choose their top 10, in my view, their job then is to make sure everybody they recruit fits into those values. Because if they do that, then actually the whole company will operate within the same set of values. I've seen so many times in large organizations where even the senior team have set values and then they don't live by it themselves, which then makes a mockery of it running down throughout the business. So it starts from the top, pick those values.
You know, Andy, as you're saying this, I'm thinking to myself, and I can just paraphrase it. There was a company that went belly up a number of years ago, very scandalous, Exxon. And they had their value statement, their mission statement, all that kind of stuff. And they said, you know, this is an equal workplace. Intolerance has no place here. Honesty and integrity are our bywords, that kind of stuff. When the truth of the matter is they were very far from that. They were the diametric opposite. And I'm also thinking about doctors and other healthcare practitioners who are part of our audience may be listening to this and saying, well, I don't have a large organization. I have an office. But I know that when I was practicing in the United States and I hired my executive assistant, as they're now called, a lady named Linda, who I loved to death. Linda was amazing. She had my values, which were that every patient should be treated with kindness, courtesy, and speed. And, you know, no patient has to wait longer than is absolutely necessary for a test result or a procedure. And yeah, I have doctor friends who say, God, my receptionist, she's very efficient, but she's very nasty. They're not hiring to a value system. So it doesn't matter on the size of your organization, does it?
No. I mean, it becomes more difficult the larger the organization. From a point of view, you've just got to find more and more of the same sort of people.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Andy. Key thing, when you say the same sort of people, you're not talking people who see the world through exactly the same optic from an operational perspective. You're talking about the way they comport themselves, because differing opinions are healthy, right, in an organization.
Yeah, but we're not talking about opinions. We're talking about values, you know.
Just wanted to make the point.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, people have a value set. Often people say, well, you know, we're going to change people's values. But the way I look at it is if you think about our prisons are full of certain members of society that don't fit some of society's standard values, if you like. They go in prison, and with resources that prisons have at their disposal for rehabilitation, they spend this time, they try and get these people back on the straight and narrow, but the reoffend rate is absolutely alarmingly high. So if prisons can't change somebody's values, then in business, we're not set up with the wherewithal to be able to change people's values. So the values are people's values. And the job of the leader of the organization, in my view, is to make sure everybody they hire has the same value set as them.
So we're going to come on to, you know, you've told us about the life change. You were displaced from your 25-year career and you had to go and find something else to do. And you're going to tell us about that. But I remember when you're a coach, you work as a coach, life and business coaching. I remember asking you about this because I was not familiar with those concepts. And you said to me, I never thought of it. You said to me, I wouldn't be fazed at having a coach for music or for a sport. Why not for life or business? Tell us how you became a coach, got your start, and all that, you know, given that you now run a very successful coaching business and I've seen you in action and you're damn good at it.
Okay, so when I left that original job, I went back round the circuit because, you know, being thrown that spanner in the work, so to speak, was a bit shocking. I'd got responsibilities to look after at home, etc. So I went back round the circuit, the interview circuit, and I went into all the same sorts of businesses that I'd been in before. I was really quite sort of sensitive to this culture sort of argument at this point in time. And I can remember I went round and I was seeing the same sort of culture misfits as I went round. And then I ended up going to a seminar that was put on by a couple of business coaches. And they were talking about business and they talked about values in this seminar. And they were trying to engage business owners to take up coaching. Well, I guess from that, I caught the bug. I looked at it and I said, you know, I don't necessarily want to be coached as a business owner. I'd like to become a coach. And an interesting story that happened to me sort of after that was I'd made the decision to become a coach. And then I went back for a final third interview at one of these companies. I'd 99% made the decision. And the guy who was interviewing me was, he desperately cut across my value set. And I think you always know if somebody violates your values, because when you meet them for the first time, you can generally tell if you don't connect with them in some way, it's possibly because they're violating one of your values. And this guy said to me right at the end of the interview, he said, right, and he was really arrogant with his whole mannerisms. And he said, okay, I've got one last question for you. He said, if I was to take you on in this role, he said, do you think you would be able to make an impact in my organization? And he'd kind of annoyed me so much that I just decided to be arrogant back. And I said to him, look, I said, given what you've shown me today, I said, it would be really difficult not to make an impact. And he said to me, he said, I like you. I want to hire you. And I thought, well, that's not me. I can't be that person. I only was like that because he annoyed me. I'd made the decision then. So I said, right, that's it. I'm going to engage on this business coaching. I'm going to try and change business. I'm going to try and make a difference, if you like.
Well, let's drill down into that. Each time I've sat in a meeting with you, and I alluded to this a little earlier, I've been really impressed at your ability to listen and distill what's going on and helping people see the way forwards with really clear, cogent, pointed observations. And I sit there and it's like, damn, why didn't I think of that? Tell us, what's the trick? How do you do it? Because I think it's a skill that I've tried to learn from you, Andy, because I've thought, you know, I want to be better at helping the people I sit in meetings with. So how do you do it? What's the trick? And is that something you learn or is it something that, you know, it's just something you were born with?
I don't necessarily think there's any such thing as necessarily born with. One of my favorite books, Bounce, is about doing 10,000 hours of purposeful practice. You know, there's reasons why for example, some tennis players are very good by the time they're 18. It's because they started playing when they was two. So I think it must be learned. How it was learned is really difficult. I'm a bit of an internal thinker. In other words, I have to sit, listen, and process. I've done lots of coaching training. I've been on some wonderful coaching training. I've been privileged to sit in front of some great people who do this for a profession. And it does all come down to listening, I think. The old adage from sales is two ears, one mouth, use them in that proportion. I think that the other saying is, if you're actually talking, you're learning nothing because you're only reiterating what you already know. The only time we can ever learn is when we're listening or we're observing or something like that. So it's all about kind of letting everybody have their say, piecing together the information and then saying, okay, so based on that, and I think probably the engineering problem-solving skills come in, and it's saying, okay, given all those informations, what is a solution that fits all of the data that we have? Maybe it comes from that. I wish I could be clear and say, absolutely, this is the exact answer to your question.
Well, I guess people should just have to see you in action. You see, because it strikes me that being able to listen, and my question was Machiavellian in part, the ability to listen, to really listen, is critical to be good at whatever one does. I interviewed a chap the other day who was, he basically, his position was, we're all in sales. Doesn't matter what we do, we're selling. So as a doctor, I'm selling trust. I'm selling to people, trust me, I know what I'm doing, and I've got your best, your best intentions at the heart of everything I say. And so listening in healthcare is probably more so than any other pursuit. Have you helped people who work in my world as clinicians? And if so, what sort of observations have you made? Nobody taught me how to observe or coach me how to be the best version of myself. Should medical schools have you teach a course, Andy?
There's two parts to that question. Have I helped other people, clinicians? Depends how you're going to describe a clinician. I've done a lot of work with like a veterinary practice where you could argue the vets were actually clinicians. I've worked with a doctor's surgery briefly. And the thing that strikes me is with stuff like this is when I see people who come out of that arena, often they've been very well taught the technical skills. And it's the same as any business. A carpenter will start up a business in carpentry because they're good at cutting wood. As they grow a business, they're no longer cutting wood. If you think about a clinician is presumably trained in how to do the clinical side of the business, not necessarily all the other things. And I was quite shocked at the time, this is a couple of years back now, that I was told that a lot of the vets that get trained on all the various procedures. One of them is how to put an animal to sleep. But they've never had one course, one module in their education about how do you actually tell somebody you're going to put their animal to sleep? For me, that's a really crucial part, if you like, of the business. Also, if you take somebody comes in with an animal and you've got to tell them that they need this procedure or that procedure and you're going to have to open up your wallet to actually pay to have this procedure done. Sales is something that a lot of people shy away from. They don't like the label of, I am a salesman. But if you can't sell, you can't help the patient, the animal in this situation. So I think in all businesses, we're taught how to do the physical role, but it's all the other stuff around it, which is not often understood by business owners and often quite a few other people in the organization. If you take when I grew up through the management chain, I'd got the technical skills. The bit of managerial came in after that, But what about the marketing? What about the sales? What about the finance? What about the HR? There's so many other things around it. Communication skills. It's amazing what else I believe we should be taught.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about your story about the vet. You're absolutely right. But then again, I remember the very first day I was an intern, and I'll never forget it, that I was the last man standing, if you will, in the emergency room after a lady was brought in extremis, and she succumbed to a cardiac event. And I was delegated as the one to go and talk to the family and tell them that this lady had died. And as I'm going in there, I thought, no one's taught me how to do this. I have no idea what I'm doing. And then further, when I first set up an office to be, you know, a surgeon, no one had taught me how to hire, how to interview, how to run HR within my organization, facilities management, banker, nothing. And in fact, you told me, Andy, that people start businesses because it's something they love or they're good at, or preferably both. But the actual running of the business has got very little to do with that. So, boy, I think you're going to be very busy after this, not that you aren't already.
I mean, if you think about that, there's so many. If you were hiring somebody, when you said you started your practice up or whatever you were doing there, and you were hiring somebody to run that for you, what would you have looked for on their CV? Because it probably wouldn't have been what was on your CV. It would have been all those things that you've just listed. The HR, the hiring, the firing, the marketing, the sales, the facilities management, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at the CV of most people who run a small business, their CV is very heavily the technical and nothing else.
It's very, very interesting. I mean, I did eventually come to my senses and hire a brilliant lady, Carol, who just, I had no idea what she was doing, but stuff happened and it went well. And yeah, that was really great. So I want to switch topics a little bit, but it speaks to who you are as an individual. For about a decade now, you've been working with a wonderful children's charity, Kids Inspire, and you paid me the honor of letting me come to one of their events. Please tell us why this particular organization caught your heart and mind, and what sort of programs they run. So shamelessly promote Kids Inspire. And by the way, this is not lip service on your part. The audience needs to understand that, just as you were talking about before about values, this is very much a part of the fabric of who you are as a man. I know that to be true.
Okay, so Kids Inspire is a children's mental health charity. And I'll read the statement that says what the mission statement is. It's to ensure that all children in the UK receive specialist support to become healthy adults who lead complete and fulfilling lives, and to provide and share inspiration and best practice with other providers across the education, health and private sectors. Now, I had a lovely childhood. I had a brilliant upbringing, and I like to think, you know, I was helped in that regard. I see so many of my clients, if you like, who have had more challenging upbringings, if you like. And I do business coaching. I'm not a therapist, wouldn't even go there. There is a line that you don't go past. But in business coaching, we see a lot of the time what actually stops somebody from doing something is, I call it the headship between their ears. It's the stuff, it's experiences. You know, I talked to one guy once and he'd got a couple of people work for him and he said, they're useless. I can't get anything out of them. So I said, well, why do they still work for you? He said, well, you can't get rid of people these days. He said, not only that, it's a second generation business. And my parents passed them down as employees when they left the business. So I said, all right, okay. So I said, how long ago was it that they'd left the business? And this guy said, it's 20 years. So I said, so for 20 years, you've had this person work for you. They're not doing a good job. They're causing you all sorts of troubles and you're still employing them. Why haven't you let them go? And it's all those, these are the difficult things to do sometimes. And it's all past experiences that make that either easy, not easy. And we have a lot of challenges with it. Now, a lot of these things have been from what they've had as past experience, how they grow up. I know there's a high sort of level of dyslexia in business owning, if you like. Even Richard Branson lists it as one of his skills on LinkedIn, dyslexic thinking. It's amazing how many business owners in this country are actually dyslexic. There's a high prevalence of ADHD. And it's all these challenges, attention deficit. I'm not going to start trying to talk to you about that, Jonathan. You probably know loads more than I'll ever know about it. But this charity, Kids Inspire, looks at kids who are not getting the breaks in life. And it's not always necessarily the underprivileged kids. Often it's the kids of very wealthy parents who have challenges. I think right at the moment, if you take COVID and people being off and isolated for 18 months or so, kids going back to school, the demand for children's mental health has skyrocketed for this because they've isolated, they've now got to get used to going back into school. And I joined the charity pretty much when it started, and it was for personal reasons. I had divorced from my wife. My kids were going through some of these same sorts of challenges, and I didn't know enough about it at the time to help them, but they were badly affected by this kind of situation. And Sue Bell, absolutely amazing lady who started this charity, who incidentally received an OBE in this year's honours list for the work that she's doing there. She came to us and said, look, you know, I've started up this charity. I don't know what I'm doing, really. And I said, right, okay, my bit to charity, because I care about this, because I understand a little bit about it, my bit to charity is I will coach you for nothing from the start. And so that's how I got involved originally. And I have to say, it's an absolute privilege to be able to help and make that sort of impact, if you like.
Yeah, it really is. And I've certainly encouraged my kids to, over the years, to be involved in something where you're giving back, because it actually rewards you, because it's grounding, it's foundational, and it allows you to see the world through a very, very different set of eyes. So, Andy, my final question for you, I love asking people this. Imagine you're walking along the beach one day and you spy a shiny, old-fashioned lamp rocking backwards and forth in the surf. You pick it up, give it a rub, and out pops a genie. And when this magical creature asks you how you might use three wishes to help humanity, what would Andy Sleet say?
Oh, they've got to help humanity, have they?
Yep, they're going to help.
I can't win the lottery or something like that.
No. Well, you couldn't. Guess you'd have to give it all away. But this is a... Look, I mean, it's lovely when you talk to people about this and they start negotiating. This is a magical lamp with a genie, right? It ain't happening, brother.
Okay, so I think I would have to say, if you go down a lot of the conversation that we had, I think it would be more about teaching people life skills from an early age. I think a big percentage of the country has an employee mindset. Teaching system is an employee. The teachers are employees. University, the lecturers are employees. The country is run by employees. It's the thing that helps money flow, the things that's going to make a difference in the world is prosperity. I think the more we can teach people entrepreneurialism, I think that would be absolutely massive. I would love to see that as part of a school curriculum. I think communication skills are another one. How to communicate, how to get your point over. It's kind of what we talked about earlier, sales. How do you do sales? How do you talk to people and tell them, for example, somebody in their family's died? These are huge things, part of life that we should actually understand. And I think the last one's money management. If you haven't read the wonderful book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, put it on your reading library, on your reading list. My view is that everybody should have that as part of the national curriculum at school. There's a kid's version of it. It's about how to manage money. I think if we can help people in that way from an early age, the money will start to flow. The money starts to flow, then we're able to help those that are less fortunate. So I would say, let's put it into education. Education, education, education. But not technical education.
How to live a good and full life. Is that it? Nothing else? You know, other wishes for humanity?
I think with that education, what people we can then do good with it. If you take somebody like Bill Gates, I think recently when he set up his foundation, he put $20 billion into it. He then got Warren Buffett involved, who put $30 billion into it. That's $50 billion into a foundation that's going to do good for humanity. If we can make money like this and people will give back, it's all about giving back, isn't it?
Yeah.
The more we can give back, the more that we can help those who are less fortunate. I think there's too much in this world of people making money for money's sake and then just keeping it or not doing, you know, what they could with it. But I think if you take something like the two guys, the foundation we've just been talking about, the amount of good that they can do for humanity would be absolutely massive.
Yeah, but by bringing people together, we make it a better world for all of us. By driving people apart, we make it a bad world for all of us.
Yeah.
So I'm with you.
Yeah.
Andy Sleet, as with each time we've chatted in the past, thank you for your wise thoughts and for taking the time to join us today.
You're very welcome, and thank you for allowing me on. I must admit, you know, repay the compliment. I actually find engaging with you in these sorts of conversations, there's just as much for me to learn. How I've learned what I've learned is from learning off of other people. Not a lot of what I come up with is new thoughts. I'm a great believer these days in there's a lot of people who put themselves out there to be thought leaders. I think more and more people are thought aggregators. They're just picking up bits from other people, but then putting it in their own words as such. So it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Well, likewise, Andy. Thank you so much. Well, folks, you can learn more about Andy and the work he does at his website, which we will put in the show notes. And also we'll put in a link there to Kids Inspire, which is a marvelous, marvelous charitable organization. So sad to say that's it for today. Please do check out our prior episodes. They're all archived there. And make sure you subscribe for a new podcast each week from EMG Health. Until then, thanks for listening. Stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.